You are listening to the Brighton Book Club on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, a monthly show about books and writing in Brighton and beyond. We've got a jam-packed Christmas special for you this month. We speak to five writers of Christmas books, from gothic romance to queer romantic comedies to ghost stories and more. I'm joined by Elizabeth Perry, who runs through the top five fiction and non-fiction bestsellers this year and suggests alternative recommendations you may not have heard of but need to know about. I also speak to journalist and writer Yasmin Floyer about our Brighton Book Club book, Claire Keegan's short but powerful Small Things Like These, which was recently shortlisted for the Booker Prize. The Book Club is available wherever you get your podcasts. Please do subscribe, rate and review us. Think of it as a little festive tip. Enjoy the show. Hayley Webster, welcome to the Brighton Book Club. Can you tell us about your wonderful novel, One Christmas Night?
Hello there. Yes, it's a book set in Norwich on a street, on one street. It starts at 3 a.m. on Christmas Eve and it finishes at 11:45 on Christmas Day. And it sort of works in real time. So each chapter follows a different person and a different household throughout the street and things that are happening. And the overall framing of the book, somebody's been stealing Christmas presents. So there's an overall mystery, they're trying to solve that. But actually the main stories really are what's going on behind closed doors on this street with all these different people living there. So.
And why did you decide to set it over Christmas? Because in theory with this format, you know, you could have applied it to every day.
Yeah, it's true. The main thing, the main reason I chose Christmas is I feel like Christmas is a really evocative time of the year. In the book, there's people dealing with loss of loved ones or financial difficulties, all sorts of things. So I felt like setting it at Christmas would, I think a lot of people, lots of things come to the front at Christmas. Some people feel things more keenly, maybe, good and bad things, lovely memories, not so good memories. A lot of stuff is for show at Christmas as well. So that fine line between the perfect Christmas and then the reality behind that. And also, when I first wrote it, I'd wrote a thread on Twitter that wrote about my favourite memory of a Christmas story, and it went viral. Was shared by lots of people. It had tens and thousands of retweets. And that was when somebody said, oh, have you ever thought about setting a book at Christmas? And I was like, I would like to do that.
So what books and writers have inspired you? Because it's no secret that kind of writing about Christmas and Christmas stories are a big kind of genre and a big selling point in the industry. What books and stories have inspired you?
I know it's one that everybody thinks of, but when I first read Christmas Carol, I was really young. My parents had these, I think they were show books, that you could get them with Reader's Digest or something on the shelves. So they were there to look, and I picked up the thinnest one, first of all, and the thinnest one was Christmas Carol because it's not a novel. And I read it at Christmas. I must have been 8 or 9, so I was quite young. And I was alone in my bedroom and it was dark, and I probably had a little light or a torch, and just the whole ambiance of the story and following these characters and the details, and the whole somebody learning that Christmas isn't about, you know, stuff, but also understanding the difference between someone who has a lot and who doesn't, and all the Victorian details and things.
What is your favourite Christmas Carol adaptation?
There's been so many good ones. I mean, I remember seeing the original, you know, the black and white one as a kid and loving that, and I still love that. Muppet's Christmas Carol is so good. It's underrated. Well, it's not because everyone loves it, but people don't. I mean, it really is. It's very good, and it gets loads of the stuff right, I think. I think it's brilliant. And partly that's because Michael Caine does play it straight, doesn't he? He plays, and then they interact with each other as if it's real. So my daughter and I always watch Muppet's Christmas Carol every year. And, you know, I don't know if this is a popular choice, but I really liked the sort of that animation that was I'm trying to think who directed it, but he directed the Polar Express as well, and it had Jim Carrey as Scrooge. I actually think that's brilliant. It really is quite dark and it's really good.
So One Christmas Night has been highly praised for its warmth, but without being too sentimental, how do you maintain this balance in your writing?
I think trying to be honest about the things that matter to people and the things that people are going through and the difference between someone's thoughts and how they're acting is quite a big one on that. I wanted to sort of explore all sorts of things in the book. There's two people who were care leavers who'd had a difficult time, who were trying to work out what Christmas means to them. There's a family who's lost their mum. There's somebody who's living in a coercive relationship, who's at, on the outside very successful, and her husband is very successful. So I think the moments where people connect and really see each other, that's where the warmth comes from, rather than sort of a performance or a statement. Or so it's that, I think.
And how can we find And Follow You, Hayley, and get our hands on a copy of One Christmas Night?
You can find me on Twitter, if it's still there, when it's still there. I'm Hayley, though, so that's H-A-Y-L-E-Y, and then the word though on there. And that's probably the best place to find me. I'm also on Instagram as that as well. And the book is available at any online bookstore that you might like to look it up in, whatever your favourite one is, it's available there.
Lottie James is a Mills and Boon author and the writer of The Gentleman of Holly Street, one of this Christmas's hottest romances. I am joined in the Virtual Brighton Book Club studio by Lottie, who is going to tell us about The Gentleman of Holly Street. Welcome.
Thank you very much for having me. Hello.
Can you tell us about this book?
Of course I can. It is not playing favourites, but one of my favourites I've written so far. It is a gothic romance, Christmas story, ghost story, all melded into one. It's set in the 1830s, mainly in London, so a bit of an urban setting. And it follows our gentleman of Holly Street, Freddie, who suddenly comes home from a long voyage to realize that he has unfortunately fallen in love with his best friend. And bum, 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 of course, it's around the holidays, so lots of good cheer as they try to figure out what to do with their feelings for each other.
And this is part of a series, right?
It is, in fact, part of the Gentleman of Mystery series. So it's a little trilogy that started with The Housekeeper of Thornhallow Hall, continued with The Marquess of Yew Park House, and of course finishes with The Gentleman. And it's these little gothic romances that follow our little Gentleman of Mystery and all the mysteries surrounding them and their houses and their lives.
Why did you decide to set this book around Christmas?
I hadn't written a Christmas book actually yet, and I love reading Christmas books. I love watching Christmas romances, and I was like, well, I think Freddie deserves a Christmas book, and it just kind of fit the setting and fit the story I needed to tell. So that's what happened.
Now, Mills and Boon are a very specific type of book. For anyone listening that isn't aware of them, can you give us a bit of an overview of Mills and Boon Publishing?
So Mills and Boon and Harlequin are some of the oldest publishers of category romance. So they have various different lines, including historical, for which I write. And a lot of people believe that there is a specific formula to Mills and Boon. And I would say that the only real formula that I've found in Mills and Boon books is that they're a bit shorter than other romances. There's such a huge variety in the Mills and Boon lines. It's just fabulous to write with them because the only formula is a happy ever after and maybe a little bit shorter than you might otherwise find, but that's all we are.
So readers of romance will love your books, I am sure. But what writers of romance inspire you?
There are so many. I can't even begin to name them. I would say, first of all, a lot of the writers who write specifically in the historical line for Mills and Boon were definitely writers that I started reading and just fell in love with and prompted me to want to pursue that kind of writing. Of course, there's the greats, you know, Sarah McLean and Tessa Dare, all those. They're just, you know, incredible, fun writers that I adore reading, but I consume everything. So picking your favorite is like picking your favorite star. I don't think I can do that.
So you also run writing workshops. What are your top tips for writing romance?
My top tip would be bring joy to yourself, first of all, and just infuse your writing with joy, even if it is heavy subjects or darker romance, whatever you're writing, just put that joy into it, because that's what makes a romance really strong, is falling in love with the characters as they fall in love with each other. And I would say read. Even if it's not in the genre you want to write in, just read it, because there's so much out there. It just sparks your imagination and, you know, inspires you. So those would be my two big ones.
And how can we find Anne-Folie Lottie and get our hands on a copy of The Gentleman of Holly Street?
Well, there are several options for that. Thank you for asking. You can, of course, head over to my website. There's plenty of links there, or just head straight to Mills and Boone or Harlequin and grab it there.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Murder on the Christmas Express is the new book out now by Alexandra Benedict. Alexandra, welcome to the Brighton Book Club.
Thank you very much indeed. Thank you very much for having me.
Can you tell us, please, about Murder on the Christmas Express?
Absolutely. This is my new book out now, and it's set on December the 23rd and Christmas Eve. And ex-Met Detective Roz Parker is on her way back up to Scotland, where she was born and raised, because her daughter is having a baby. Her daughter's gone into premature labour, and so she's taking the sleeper train all the way up to Fort William to be with her. And she thinks it's going to be, she's left detection behind her, that that's in her past and it's the future of baby looking after and being a grandma. But before that happens, if that happens, she has to solve murders that happen on that sleeper train.
This is so exciting. Now, although Murder on the Christmas Express is a standalone book, this is the second of three books that you are writing in the kind of Christmas series. Can you tell us about the first one and then the forthcoming one?
Yes, last year I released the Christmas Murder Game, which was out from Bonnier Zaffer, and that is set in Yorkshire, North Yorkshire, and is a proper stately home, locked room, a family secrets unveiled as a game is played to win the house, and one by one family members are picked off. And so it's trying to find out who is behind that and who will win the house at the end of it. Whereas next year, my Christmas book is The Christmas Jigsaw Murders, where the detective receives a small piece of a jigsaw, which suggests that a crime is going to be committed. And they have to find the rest of the jigsaw to solve it.
What is it about Christmas and murders that gets you so excited?
I love Christmas. I am wearing a Santa hat right now. I don't do that all year. I'm either in Halloween mode or Christmas mode all year round. I don't really do the other times of year. And when they do happen, I just avoid it, if at all possible. I love the light and shade, so bringing the lightness that is at Christmas. I also like looking at the darkness that happens at the same time. So I think Christmas and the darker side of human nature go together quite well. But I really love all the brightness and the lights and the joy and the love that goes hand in hand with Christmas. So it kind of brings the two sides of my interests and personality together as well.
Which writers inspired you? So I'm definitely getting a big kind of Agatha Christie vibe. Would I be right?
You are very right indeed. Agatha Christie is, she's like my spiritual aunt. I go to her books for advice. I called my dog Dame Margaret Rutherford after Margaret Rutherford, who played Miss Marple in some of the Agatha Christie adaptations. I read Agatha Christie all year round. I read all of her books at least once a year. But I also love all the other Golden Age mysteries as well. So I love Dorothy L. Sayers and Marjorie Allingham and Nio Marsh. And I love how they appear to be cosy, but they're not at all. They are dark mistresses. So I love the play of humour and darkness.
So you, Alexandra, did your MA in creative writing in Sussex and lived here for a while a few years ago. I'd love to know what you loved about being a writer here in Brighton.
I did my MA in Brighton and lived in Brighton. And so when I was younger, being a student in Brighton was just wonderful. Being able to be in the middle of things and go to gigs, comedy, everything is just there for you, and the sea. I've also lived in Hastings and I'm now in Eastbourne. So I have just gone along the south coast of Sussex, just popping into the seaside towns. And I love them all. They've all got a different flavour and a different vibe. But there's the light is beautiful. There is a beauty and darkness to the south coast and to Brighton and Hastings in particular that I adore.
Which also can be reflected in your fabulous books. So, Alexander, absolutely. How can people get their hands on a copy of The Murder on the Christmas Express this Christmas?
Murder on the Christmas Express is available at Waterstones. It's available at indie bookshops around the country. There's a special edition for indie bookshops with spreads of train tracks around the outside. It's also for sale in Sainsbury's at £8, very reasonably priced, and is on Amazon as well. And basically lots of other places where you can get books.
And how can we find and follow you and keep abreast of your forthcoming Christmas wonderful books?
Oh, thank you. I'm on Twitter, for however long that lasts, at @AK_Benedict. I'm on Instagram as AK Benedict 2, on Facebook as Alexandra Benedict. And I just joined Hive and I am at AK Benedict on there.
Thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you so much, Anna.
Andy Leach is the publisher, writer and founder of the 72.1 imprint. Welcome to the Brighton Book Club, Andy. Can you tell us about 72.1?
Yeah, 72.1 was something that came about 18 months ago now. I'd been talking to a friend of mine, Hannah Persaud, a writer, who you may know, I don't know. And we'd been chatting for ages about launching our own imprint, and we'd both recently gone through a period where we'd split from agents and the book world wasn't treating us the way we hoped it might. A familiar story, I think. We just kind of decided, you know, we've been talking about launching an imprint, shall we just go for it? And there and then on the phone we decided that we would make our first publication a anthology of climate fiction. This was in about the July of last year. We then contacted just about everybody we knew, including booksellers and all manner of writers. Pretty much everyone said yes, which was wonderful. So we ended up with a work that included work by people like Selena Godden, which was fantastic. So from concept, that book came out in about 4 months, which was kind of part of the impetus, was to show that it could be done. so many books take forever, don't they? And by the time they come out, it's kind of, people have forgotten why they wrote them, I think. And from that book, it then sort of 72.1 became a celebration of short stories. And so the chapbook series that's become the big thing this year has really been to put short stories on the map and to say to people, you know, you don't need to necessarily buy an anthology. You can buy a short story in its own little imprint, stick it in your pocket, carry literature around. So again, inviting authors who I knew and liked and wanted to publish their work. So we had Antonia Honeywell for our first book back in the spring of this year. Her first thing in print, I think I'm right in saying, since The Ship, which was her novel of 2018, I think, something like that. And since then, it's continued to gain support. It's really been something that has got Twitter behind it. So if Twitter does disappear, I'm not quite sure what we're going to do for for publicity, because nothing else seems to work as well. And we've just grown a database steadily and surely. Making it subscription only was really twofold. It was to make sure that the cash flow works, if I'm being brutally honest, from a business point of view. You know, we always know where we are financially at 72.1. But it also marks it out as something a little bit different. It creates a sense of community, a sense of family. And it means that when people start to subscribe to our books, they feel like they're joining something, and it makes a really nice sort of collegiate, happy band of people that follow us and want us. And we're now up to several hundred subscribers, so you know, from a standing start, we're doing okay. Books come out once a quarter. So we do a spring, summer, autumn and winter book. The winter ones have just today come back from the printers, so they'll be going out quite soon.
Can you tell us about your latest kind of ghostly December Christmassy chapbook?
Yeah, I always like to do something. I always feel Christmas should be something, I don't know, a bit different to the rest of the year. Just try and mark it a bit. And therefore, the idea of doing a Christmas collection means that the December book is very different to the other three that have gone before it. All of the chapbooks so far have been single stories. They're about 5,500 words each. The Christmas one is a celebration of Christmas ghost stories, I guess. And it was partly by invitation and partly a few people who contacted us and said, look, I've got an idea, I'd like to do one. So we invited a very limited amount of submissions to come in for it. And I ended up selecting three stories that are all completely different, but all have at their heart that notion of Christmas and ghosts and looking back and the past. You know, there's one in there that is quite a shocking, scary story. There's another that's a bit more sort of M.R. James in its approach. And there's another one that's very modern, that's completely different to all the others. So it's a way of saying, look, the Christmas chapbook needs to be something that actually celebrates the season that it comes out in.
Why would a subscription to your fab chapbooks be a great Christmas gift, and how can people subscribe?
First off, they can subscribe by going to the website massiveoverheads.com/books. And there you will see two options to subscribe. One is an annual subscription, which is £18, and one which is a monthly subscription, which is £1.50 a month. What we try and do is keep them extremely affordable. So, I mean, it's one of our contributors to the Christmas one, Stu Hennigan, who's a bit flavour of the month this year with his ghost signs book, no pun intended, I suppose. He's been a huge supporter of ours, and he always says, you know, it's cheaper than your average cup of coffee from Starbucks. You know, it's you can get great literature for at a price that means you can virtually forget about the fact that you're subscribing. In terms of why it would make a great Christmas gift, it means that people kind of forget they've done it, and then every 3 months they get a little book through the post, which is a lovely thing. So if you've got somebody that likes short story formats, that likes good literature, you can send them a subscription. I mean, we had a couple last year who said, you know, the trouble with this is I've got nothing physical to send. So we made little cards and sent them out to people and said, you know, congratulations, you're now on the list. 70-1 was because it values the short story in as much as no book that we publish will be more than 70,000 words, and no book will be less than 1,000 words. We don't do flash fiction. We don't do great big long tomes. We do that little sweet spot in the middle. So anthologies will always be quite slim, and individual stories will always be more than 1,000 words. So you're getting something quite chunky, but at the same time, not too overbearing. So that's kind of the 70-1 imprint via Massive Overheads. That's the connection.
And how can we find and follow you on social media, Andy?
Massive Overheads is the name on Twitter. Just miss out the E from massive, because otherwise it doesn't fit. Simple as that. That's the best way of getting to us. MASSIV Overheads on Twitter. That's pretty much everything goes through there. We've also got an Instagram, 70-1 books. It's 70 as a word, digit 2, 1 as a word, and then _ books. That's our Instagram.
Thank you very much for joining us. Lizzie Huckley-Jones is the author of Make You Mine This Christmas, a alternative queer love story, which is out now and is sure to warm your cold hearts this winter. Lizzie, welcome to the Brighton Book Club.
Thanks for having me, Anna.
Can you tell us about Make You Mine This Christmas?
I can indeed. So Make You Mine This Christmas is a big, chaotic, silly holiday rom-com in the style of the classic Christmas movies, but with a queer and disabled twist. The top line is that it's fake dating, but with a fun little sapphic twist. It all starts where Hav, our main character, who's a chaotic bisexual plus size woman, goes to a party, meets a guy called Christopher, who she kind of has a fun time with. They see some singed mistletoe, and they feel like they have to have a kiss under the mistletoe in order to be like, you've done your job, you can pass on now. And that all seems fun and it's a terrible kiss. But the problem is they're seen by his ex-girlfriend, Laurel, who mistakenly thinks that he's moved on and has got a new girlfriend, and Hav, determined to help him save face, just pretends that she is his girlfriend. All seems fine, a great plan to get through a Christmas party, except the next day Laurel has told everyone that they are dating and his mother insists that she comes down for Christmas. And because Hav has nothing better to do, because she's a chaos agent, she just agrees. She's like, sure, I've just met you, I will be your girlfriend for Christmas at this intimate family gathering. And all that seems to be going as well as could possibly be until she meets a girl at the St. Pancras bookshop and for the first time in ages feels something and is like, oh my God, I'm having feelings. I'm so excited. She's so beautiful. But then she leaves, this girl leaves. And so she's like, Hav's like, maybe it just wasn't meant to be. Except that when they get back to Christopher's family home, the bookshop girl is his sister. And so Hav has to spend Christmas pretending to be Christopher's fake girlfriend while trying not to fall desperately in love with his sister, Kit.
Now, if that hasn't encouraged every single person listening to go out and buy a copy of Make You Mine This Christmas, I have no idea what will. This brings together all of my kind of favourite tropes in a romantic comedy, but sets them at this kind of magical time of year. So one thing you do in your fiction, Lizzie, is you really centre queerness and disability in your writing, but you don't make that the plot. Can you talk a bit about breaking the norm in these kind of very well-trodden genres and how easy or not it was to get your voice heard?
So I was really lucky in that I was paired up with an editor who was like, let's come up with some really cool ideas. And they were just so keen for me to just make it as gay as possible, make it as disabled as possible. Hodder have been super, super supportive of that. So I must say that I've been really lucky to have publisher backing from like the get-go. For me, I've wanted to tell some kind of rom-com story for so long. I love romantic comedies. I think a rom-com movie is like the perfect little treat at the end of the day. And all my favorite films that I go back to all the time are rom-coms, like Dan in Real Life, which I think if you also love, you will see a lot of in my book, and the Happiest Season that I really love, and a lot of my feelings from watching that went into this book. But you're right, romance has traditionally been a very heterosexual area. It's a very white area, and it's a very, very abled area. And so for me, queerness and disability are really inextricably linked in my personal life as a queer disabled person. And I have a lot of queer disabled people around me. And yet I didn't really see that in books. I did see some amazing disability representation by authors Talia Hibbert and Helen Huang, who I always name check because I think their books are great. And if you love romance, you will love their books. But I didn't really see the queerness as well. It was like one or the other. It's like you can't have multiple intersections. And so I really wanted to tell that story, especially because in my personal life, I've been with my partner 9 years. Our romance is very inextricably linked with caring and like looking after each other. And my disabilities have always been just a matter of fact. And I wanted to write that. And I wanted to write that truth because I think so often in the world that we are told that disability is negative, or you can't be romantic if you're disabled, you can't be sexual if you're disabled. And I want to posit that you can be all of those. And also it can be a kind of neutral factor in your life. You know, everyone has baggage, everyone has their own stuff to deal with. And for Kit, it's that sometimes her joints dislocate at will. And for other people, maybe, you know, that everyone has something. And it doesn't have to be like a terrible bad thing. It can just be a factor in your life. And so kind of that's what the mindset I was thinking of going into it. And also I do have an author's note at the end, but Hav is autistic, but she doesn't know she is yet. Because when I was writing her, I was like, so many of her decisions and the way she struggles to like navigate the world is really pulled from this time in my life when I was like early 20s chaos demon myself. And I realized that part of that was the not knowing how your own brain works and how you fit into society. And so she is really written as an autistic person who doesn't quite know the, you know, she hasn't got the autistic training manual yet. She's still trying to be a neurotypical person and not doing it very well. So both of them are queer and disabled, which was very important to me. And it's had lovely responses from readers, both queer and disabled, and also neither. Like, according to my Amazon reviews, I seem to have found a real niche with straight men in their like middle ages who have given it a bunch of lovely reviews, which has made me very pleased.
How lovely and how refreshing. It's so nice when you reach an audience that you didn't even know was going to be yours yet. So Lizzie, you are the editor of STIM and a contributor to the Allies anthology. Can you give us a bit of a briefing about these two fab anthologies and why they might make great Christmas gifts this year?
So STIM is an anthology of work by autistic people. So it's a mixture of fiction, nonfiction, and art, all exploring different stories, different parts of their life. All of the authors happen to be autistic, and all of the pieces, while I never gave them the brief to write specifically about autism, all kind of explore autism in different ways. And so I think that if you love a literary anthology, if you love a little mix of pick and mix of different authors and voices and ideas, I think it's a really great one to pick up. We've got essays about being queer in the countryside. We've got a story about hungry ghosts and selkies, and we've got beautiful art that explores what overstimulation is and what your brain feels like. So I think that one's a great one for people who are autistic and their family members, but also people who love great literature. I can say that because I wrote only the introduction and the end matter. So it's very easy for me to go on about how brilliant it is, but it really is brilliant. And Allies, Real Talk About Showing Up, Screwing Up and Trying Again, is an anthology pitched for teenagers all about what meaningful allyship and solidarity looks like to different marginalized groups. I'm really excited to say that it's also a World Book Day book for 2023, where we've got a smaller version of just, I think, 6 essays, but the full edition is already available and out to buy now. It's pitched for teenagers, but actually we've had a lot of adults reading it who really enjoyed it. There's essays on transness, queerness, different races, racism, and various aspects of disability. My essay is all about how you can better support invisibly disabled people and how that can be tricky and you might feel a bit nervous about it, all written through the lens of I have a seizure disorder and kind of talking about how sometimes I need help when I'm out and about from strangers and how strange of an experience that can be. So that's another one. And it's both collections are really exciting, super interesting authors in all of them. So I really recommend them as gifts for anyone who wants to learn more about allyship, solidarity, autism, marginalization. It's all the good stuff.
Thank you so much for joining us, Lizzie. How can we find and follow you?
So I'm at Little Hux on Twitter and Instagram. My website is www.lizziehuxleyjones.com, and I supposedly have a newsletter, which I will be dealing with at some point. But you can find me in all of those places where I'm very noisy and don't shut up. So you will know when I've got books coming out.
Any regular listeners of the Brighton Book Club will know that our Christmas episode is my favourite of the year because I get to speak to my wonderful friend Elizabeth Perry, who was formerly a bookseller at City Books in Brighton, which is how we met each other, and is now manager of Daunt in Summertown in Oxford. So every year I like to ask Elizabeth what 5 books, fiction and non-fiction, are selling well or are their bestsellers in the shop, and what 5 alternative books she would suggest. So Elizabeth, welcome back to the Brighton Book Club. Thank you.
Thank you for having me. I'm so excited to be back.
I am really excited about this list. I've had a sneak peek, so I'm really looking forward to getting stuck in. And one thing that we really want to do with this segment is, you know, show you it's great when books are selling really well and that everyone hears about them. But it's also really nice to have an opportunity to talk about books that people might not have heard of. And because this is a funny old industry, and, you know, if there's not the budget to shout about the books, publishers often have their kind of hands tied. So I love this opportunity to bring books to the forefront that might not have already been there. So let's start with fiction. What is number one?
Number one is Carrie Soto Is Back by Taylor Jenkins Reid, which I loved and is part of the author's sort of Famous Four collection. So each of the books has been about a fictional famous person. And I think Carrie is my favourite so far. She's a fictional famous tennis player and she's fantastic. She's such a good character. One of the things I really like about Taylor's books is they are so real and immersive and they've got lots going on, but they're also just so easy to read. You can just churn through them really quickly. And particularly for me, when I'm in a bit of a reading slump, like I am right now, that kind of thing really gets me going again. And I loved it. It's a very good book.
Amazing. So if you liked Carrie Soto Is Back, what might you also like that you might not have heard of?
So I'm going to recommend The Final Revival of Opal and Nev by Dawnie Walton, which I think it was on the Women's Prize long list, but had really dropped off my radar. I hadn't come across it and I read it and completely fell in love with it. If you are familiar with Taylor Jenkins Reid, you might know her book Daisy Jones and the Six, which is about a fictional band. And Opal and Nev are a fictional 70s rock duo. And the book is... it's an oral history and you know that there's been a sensational breakup of the two. And as the book progresses, you find out that not everyone has all the information. There are some secrets that have been buried and it changes everything for the legacy of Opal and Nev, basically. And it's such a good book. When you get, there's a part in the middle where something's revealed and I did like a cartoon gasp.
Amazing. So the next book on the fiction bestseller list was the winner of this year's Booker Prize.
Yes, this is a really fun one. So the winner of the Booker Prize was The Seven Moons of Molly Almeida by Shehan Karunatilaka. And this is fun because it's a really small publisher, but it's a huge prize. So it's our bestseller, but it's probably one of the smallest publishers that I'm talking about today, I think, which I like. I like that for sort of books. That's who publishes it in the UK. And Seven Moons is narrated by a war photographer who wakes up dead in 80s Sri Lanka and has 1 week to try and get in touch with the people that has been left behind, sort of from the afterlife. And it's brilliant. It's quite... satirical, it's quite absurd, it's really gripping, it's really moving. It was the one that my brother liked the most of the shortlist, so he's feeling very smug. But it's brilliant. And I've paired it with Briefly a Delicious Life by Nell Stevens, which is also narrated by a dead person. So that's the link. This one is narrated by a teenage ghost who falls in love with the writer George Sand while she's on holiday with her partner. And those of you that are very well read like me might recognize George Sand as the author that Blair Waldorf mentions at the Dean's Parlour Game and Gossip Girl. Which is my main reference.
Absolutely wonderfully niche, and I have no idea what you're talking about.
You've not watched Gossip Girl?
XOXO, no, I haven't. Ah. So absolutely, go. That sounds really, really great by Nell Stevens. So this will be no surprise to anyone, the next one on the list. The Bullet That Missed by Richard Osman, game show host extraordinaire.
Yes, hugely popular. This is the third book in the Thursday Murder Club and our aging sleuths are back with another mystery. You're in such safe hands with Richard Osman. They're such lovely stories, good puzzles. Yeah, just a really good fun read.
So if you liked The Bullet That Missed or any of the Richard Osman Thursday Murder Club series, what else would you suggest?
So I'm going to recommend the author of my favourite cozy crime series, and that's Mia P. Manansala. And the third book in her series has just come out and is actually set at Christmas. So it's an ideal time to get involved. It's called Blackmail and Babinka. And the series all takes place in Shady Palms in the States in a restaurant. And so it's full of Filipino food and different characters. The town is kind of full of all these really quirky characters and everyone's involved in the mystery. The main character has a sausage dog. It's just a really lovely, comforting read, but also with a good puzzle. So you can use your brain cells.
That sounds so, so wonderful. That's definitely on my list. So this next one is really kind of added into the canon of sexy sad girl literature this year, which is Cleopatra and Frankenstein by Coco Millers. What would you suggest for lovers of this book, which was extraordinary?
So for this one, I would recommend Brown Girls by Daphne Pallase Andriades, which is one of my favourite novels, I think, ever, and came out earlier this year with a paperback coming out next year. It's a chorus of different characters. All of them are girls that have grown up in Queens in New York. So it's a real love letter to Queens. But it's also a real chorus of voices. You get to know all these different characters without really knowing who they are. It's very cleverly written and you follow them right to the end of their lives. It's stunning. Such a good book.
So the link between these two, a lot of it must be New York, right?
Yeah, New York. And also just having a really incredible cast of characters, because one of the things I liked so much about Cleo and Frank was each character was fantastic and so interesting and engaging. And it's the same with Brown Girls.
Wonderful. So last but not least, The Dance Tree.
So The Dance Tree takes place in 16th century France over one very, very hot summer. And a dancing plague starts, which is not something I'd ever heard of before. But basically, lots of people in the village start dancing and won't stop. And it's beautiful, really moving. I love this writer anyway, but this is my favourite thing I've read from hers. I think it's gorgeous. And I'm pairing it with All of You, Every Single One by Beatrice Hitchman, which is also historical, although more modern than Dance Tree. So it's about a woman who leaves her unhappy marriage, flees to Vienna in 1911 to be with the woman she loves. And obviously war is coming, so things are about to get more difficult. But I think I really like both of these because historical fiction for me often just feels quite cold and distant, whereas this, with queer people in it, with relationships that I recognise more, it just feels so much more alive to me. And they're both brilliant books. So, yeah.
And drum roll, please, your fiction book of the year is...
It's Her Majesty's Royal Coven by Juno Dawson, which I'm so excited about. I was so excited for it to come out and I wanted it to be good. And whenever that happens, you get kind of nervous and it was so much better than I could have imagined. It's the start of a new fantasy series, starts just after a magical civil war has happened. Group of friends in their late 30s in a top secret government department of witches. And the way... the frictions between them and the frictions, I guess, in wider society start to change their relationships. It's so fun. It's so gripping. The cliffhanger ending is agonizingly good. I cannot wait for the next book. And it really conjured that feeling for me of when you're a teenager, you come across your new favorite series and it just feels like a group of friends that you're a part of. Juno's done that really cleverly, again, with a more grown up angle to it, so it just felt so real as well as being so original and exciting. I loved it. Yeah.
So let's move on to non-fiction. So first on the list is Crying in H Mart.
Yes, this is a wonderful memoir that we've been selling so many copies of, which is great to see because it always sparks really interesting conversations when people come back and say they've read it. It's a memoir of grief and love and Korean food. And the author is also a musician known as Japanese Breakfast. So you also get the start of her music career taking off, which I thought was so interesting. But at its heart, it's about a mother, a daughter and food, I suppose. And it's just wonderful.
And if you liked Crying in H Mart, what else would you suggest?
I would recommend another memoir. This one is called Ma and Me by Putsata Riang. And this one is also about a bit of a complicated mother-daughter relationship about, so the author's parents fled Cambodia when she was only 1 year old. And their relationship over the years is always a little bit difficult. But when she's in her 40s, she tells her mother that she wants to marry a woman and is going to marry a woman. And it causes a real break in their relationship. It was beautiful. Also lots of really good food writing in it. So that was quite a nice link to Crying in H Mart as well. And the author's journalism career kind of takes off during the book. So there's a lot of parallels, but it's also just beautifully written. Two fantastic books. Maybe my two favourites of the five.
Wow. Which is not diminished this by any means.
Of course not.
This is one of my biggest celebrity crushes, is Stanley Tucci, and Taste.
Yes, yes, the legendary Stanley. This is his memoir through food. And I mean, what else do I need to say?
So you've paired this with an Alphabet for Gourmets by MFK Fisher. Can you talk a bit about this one?
Yes. So MFK Fisher was a food writer, and Daunt Books Publishing have reissued several of her books in the past. But the one this year is a book called An Alphabet for Gourmets, which is a series of essays on food in this really lovely new edition that would make a lovely present. It's got a really beautiful cover. And MFK Fisher's food writing, it's very gossipy. It's very funny. It's a little bit Nora Ephron. Michelle Zorner, author of Crying in H Mart, is a fan of her food writing. So she's also someone that I think is quite interesting to see references come up to in food writing today. And yeah, they're just very good fun to read. She's quite a character.
So unless you've been living under a rock for the last few years, you will have heard of Greta Thunberg, who has just released the climate book, hopefully printed on recycled paper.
I hope so. Yeah, I should have checked that.
What have you paired this one with?
So I've paired this with Breathing Fire by Jamie Lowe, which is a piece of nonfiction about a group of incarcerated women in California's fire camps, which is not something I'd ever heard of before, and essentially means that these women are in prison and they're working as firefighters, earning $1 an hour. In California, where wildfires are getting much worse, as we all know. And so the book is sort of a portrait of those women, as well as being a portrait of social inequality and also climate change and the way climate change is already affecting people. Like, for example, I didn't realize very wealthy people in California might have their own private firefighters. So there's already a big gap between how climate change is affecting different areas of society. It wasn't something I had any prior interest in. I just like the sound of it. I picked it up and can't stop thinking about it since I read it. I would really recommend it for someone who just likes good nonfiction and is willing to read about pretty much any topic.
So we're moving back to food writing now with India Express.
Yes. So India Express is the new cookbook from Rukmini Iyer, who you might know as the Roasting Tin author. I love her cookbooks, and this one I think is my favorite. I particularly love these cookbooks because they're so low on the washing up afterwards. And I'm pairing it with a cookbook called Taste Tibet, which is by Julie Kleeman and Yashi Jampa. And Taste Tibet is a restaurant here in Oxford that's wonderful, and the cookbook is full of brilliant recipes, beautiful photos, wonderful stories, and all the warmth that you get when you go into the restaurant. So it's the next best thing if you can't visit, is cooking from Taste Tibet.
And last but not least, we have the memoir by absolute icon, Mallory Blackman.
Yes. So this is Just Saying by Mallory Blackman. And she's such a legend. And I think particularly, I guess, for our generation, if you've grown up with an author, they feel so familiar that it felt really special to get to actually know her a bit better, and hear her talking about herself and her life and the other side of the books that we're also familiar with. Yeah, it was just such a treat. Really interesting, really moving, very inspiring.
And you've paired this with My Autobiography of Carson McCullers by Jenny Shapland.
Yes, so this is a bit of a tenuous link because it's literally just another book about a writer. Quite a different way of writing about a writer, but that's why I liked this combination. So Jen is writing about the author Carson McCullers and the way she feels their lives are entwined. So they've got lots of similarities, and there's things in there about lesbian identity and being chronically ill and being a writer. And the reason why it's called My Autobiography is sort of because it's as much about Jen as it is about Carson. And I picked this up because I read a very bad review of it and thought, that sounds brilliant. I'm really glad I did. Yeah, it's fantastic.
Nonfiction of the year for you, I'm going to do a little drum roll, is?
It is Empire of Pain by Patrick Radden Keefe, which is a fantastic book about the Sackler family and the opioid crisis in America. And it made me so angry and feel so, I don't know, I guess empowered is maybe the right word, but it was one of those books where I started it thinking, okay, this might be a good few pages to read, and ended it thinking, this is something I'll think about for the rest of my life. He's such a brilliant writer and can turn such complicated stories into a really readable narrative. It is so good.
And here is a slightly shameless, but we don't do shame here.
No, we don't.
For stocking filler of the year, because I'm terrible at self-promotion, so I'm going to hand this one over to you.
Stocking filler of the year is obviously The Little Book of It by Anna Burt and Kitty Wings, which is a glorious collection of anonymously donated icks, including my own, which is very exciting, but I'm not going to tell you which one it is. It's so funny. It's the perfect stocking filler for literally anyone in your life, because everyone will find it entertaining. And it's also very beautifully packaged with a lovely cover. It's the full thing.
And there are some games at the back, which you can play over Christmas.
It's interactive.
Loved ones. Although I'd recommend more for a friendmas rather than a family Christmas.
Yes.
So thank you so much, Elizabeth, for joining us. I'm going to pop all of these over on our Instagram. How can we find and follow you and sign up to your wonderful newsletter?
You can find me on Instagram at ec.reads, and you can sign up for my newsletter at tinyletter.com/shelf-improvement.
Our book club book this month is the new novel Small Things Like These from the internationally best-selling author of Foster, Antarctica and Walk the Blue Fields, Claire Keegan. Here is the blurb. It is 1985 in an Irish town. During the weeks leading up to Christmas, Bill Furlong, a coal and timber merchant, faces into his busiest season. As he does the rounds, he feels the past rising up to meet him and encounters the complicit silences of a people controlled by the church. This long-awaited new work is an unforgettable story of hope, quiet heroism and tenderness. I chose this book for a couple of reasons. Firstly, because it was on the booker list and I think it's nice to have a bit of representation, but also it's nice and short. And I often feel that books on the booker list can be like really high literary and often quite inaccessible. So I thought even if it was, then at least it was short, so I wasn't stuck in it for too long. However, I'm really, really glad I did, because I absolutely loved this very short and very powerful book, and I am joined by writer and journalist Yasmina Floya to talk about it. Yasmina, welcome to the Baritone Book Club.
Hello, thank you so much for having me.
What did you think of Small Things Like These?
I absolutely loved it. First of all, I love a short book, so that's something that I'm really enjoying the emergence of. I think that we're definitely seeing more of a trend for that this year, of like a nice little novel. But I just found it really packed a punch. It was very tender and really poignant. For me, it like really held that balance between tenderness and that feeling that something really bad is going to happen, and yet you don't quite get there. And I feel that's almost that for me heightens the tension, because when you're not aware of what's behind the door, that's almost more scary of actually opening it and seeing, you know, the monster. So yeah, it did a lot. It worked on so many levels for me.
There was something for it when I was reading it, that felt a bit like a parable. And there's something kind of dreamlike in its quality, and especially because it's set in the kind of days leading up to Christmas and the kind of snowy Irish landscape. But it had this really gentle lyrical language, but this really powerful dark heart about, which was kind of based on something that I'm ignorant of, which is the Magdalene Laundries in Ireland.
Yeah, I had no idea about that either. And definitely there is that undercurrent of something really dark happening in amongst that tenderness of that domesticity and family life.
And there's so much in the novel about judgment. And I did a bit of research from my friend Wikipedia about these Magdalene laundries, which were also known as Magdalene asylums. And they were institutions usually run by the Roman Catholic orders, which operated from the 18th to the 20th centuries. They were run ostensibly to house fallen women, in inverted commas. So an estimated 30,000 of whom were confined in these institutions in Ireland. And in 1993, unmarked graves of 155 women were uncovered in the Covent grounds of one of the laundries. And this led to huge media revelations, and a formal state apology was issued only in 2013, plus a £50 million compensation scheme for survivors was set up by the Irish government. And another thing as well is the religious orders which operated these laundries have rejected activist demands that they financially contribute to this programme. So it's still going on today.
Yeah, it's funny that you say that actually about things that continue, because that's something that I felt worked really well with the setting of it being around Christmas time. It's a time of tradition, and that the one scene that I absolutely loved was when you see them making the Christmas cake. And this isn't really a spoiler, but it's just so evocative. And there are throughout the book a few descriptions of food and being fed. And you know, any book that talks about food really starts to touch on things like personal history and cultural history. And in that moment, you also have the little, you know, the daughters writing their Santa's letters. Like, do you remember that scene? And I've got children myself, and I've got a teenager and an 8-year-old, and it really made me think about that almost Goldilocks period where they still believe, but then they're starting to question things. And that's something that I think that Keegan does so powerfully in the novel, is how she explores these overarching wider themes to do with society, to do with judgment and what we don't say, what we choose not to see, and the myths that we perpetuate, and how she filters that through the lens of the microcosm of the family. So for me, when I read that scene and I could see the younger child starting to question it, but then it was the older daughter, Kathleen, who steps in and makes an excuse as to why, you know, how do these letters actually reach Santa? And then that tender moment between father and daughter where he winks at her. For me, that spoke to a number of things. It was at once, you know, a beautiful moment between father and daughter. And you can see that intimacy and that almost a desperation to kind of keep his daughter safe and innocent and hopeful before the wider world comes in with all of its responsibility and sorrow. But then on the other hand, it made me a little bit sad because I was looking at Kathleen and all the responsibility that she takes on, and that tension between what she wants to do and what she has to do, you know, that idea of duty and responsibility and tradition. And in her stepping in rather than her parents to fill in that, you know, answer those questions that her younger sister had, it kind of spoke to complicity. It's like, well, you know better, you're older, you know that Santa doesn't exist, and yet you're going to be complicit in maintaining this myth. And I know that it's an innocuous myth, but I just felt it was really effective because it spoke to that wider idea of this crime that, again, I had no idea either until after I finished reading the book that this had even happened. And it's so horrific. And you think, this is actually recent history. I was born in 1984. This book is set in 85, and I had no idea. So, you know, what are we keeping quiet? I just loved that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, Yasmina, you are a voracious reader. What are some other books you've read this year that you really enjoyed?
So I would have said Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow, which you had previously spoken about in your last podcast, so I can't say that. Do you know what I really loved? I don't know if you've looked at Night Bitch by Rachel Yoder.
No.
That is, again, a nice slim book, and it's very different in terms of style and voice. It has a magic realist element about a mother, you know, that tension between mother as an artist and your creative in terms of your career, and mother as in physically have created life, and how you straddle those identities. And there's a magic realist element because the protagonist thinks that she's turning into a dog. It's just wonderful. The language is beautifully claustrophobic. And that's one thing I think that it has in common with the Claire Keegan book, whilst they're vastly different in terms of theme, that idea of setting something within the home and keeping it there, that claustrophobia of parenthood, I think works really well. But yeah, I love that. I love Night Bitch a lot, and Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow.
And how can we find and follow you?
I can be found on Instagram, I'm at Yas Floyer, and on Twitter, I'm at Yasmin Floyer.
Thank you for listening to the Brighton Book Club. I hope you got some great book buying inspiration this season. Our next book club book, suggested by Elizabeth, is The Final Revival of Opal and Nev by Dawny Walton. Grab it from your local independent and read along. I have just started it and I already know I'm in for a treat. You can follow us on Instagram at BTM Book Club, where we'll be posting all the titles we spoke about on today's show. Have a great festive period and we'll see you soon.